Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Yes. Yet again, we are burning down the house here on the one and only HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. And my gosh, time goes by. It has been over 3 years since we started this program. I failed to mention it. July 9th was our third anniversary, and we've covered so many topics. Design, architecture, the creative arts. Today I want to get a little bit away from architecture, qua architecture, but talk about, instead of the built exterior landscape, talk a little bit about our interior landscape. Joining us today in studio is an expert and connoisseur of the world of interior furnishes, furnishings, furniture, beautiful things for the inside of our structures, Daniela Ohad-Smith. Say hello.
Hi.
Very good. Daniela teaches at the School of Visual Arts, correct?
Correct.
In the DCRIT program?
Correct.
Yes. We've had Alexandra Lang join us.
I've heard that episode.
Yeah. Thank you. Was it okay?
Perfect.
Okay, good.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that you could join us, and especially on short notice, because I understand you're going to Japan soon.
Yes, on Thursday.
And what are you going to do there?
I'm going to look at design, breathe, eat amazing food.
Breathing is always good.
Yeah.
Where in Japan?
I'm going to Kyoto.
Kyoto. Are you going to take a bullet train from Tokyo?
I am.
Excellent.
Have you done it?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I've never been to Japan. I'm going to wait until I can save a little bit of money. The most recent worldwide economic crash was very hard on some of us architects.
I know.
I suppose it's you know some people who probably have been suffering. So
not only architects.
Everyone in the creative
everyone.
Arts. Yeah. I mean, it's been a very, very tough few years, and those of us who have some work to do, I think, speaking for myself at least, I'm very grateful. But I think things can only improve, I hope. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, just as an introduction.
Okay, I'm from Israel.
Yes, I'm from Chicago.
I know. I love Chicago.
Me too.
And I moved here after college. I went to Tel Aviv University. I studied art history.
Uh-huh.
Moved to New York in 1985, which is, 27 years ago. And and I've lived in New York ever since. I'm working as I can't even tell you. I don't have any title. Maybe design historian. I'm working in the design world for the past 25 years. And my last project is a program on collecting design.
Yes, and I want to talk about that.
Oh, and also I just want to mention that I did my PhD at the Bard Graduate Center.
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
Which is an amazing, amazing program.
Dr. Daniela. Okay, well, you can become part of the Oprah Network with there with Dr. Phil, and you can help people cure their design afflictions. But we're not going to get quite there today.
Okay,
what I do want to talk about, among other things, but the main topic is... which I think is part of what you're trying to discover with your teaching is how we populate and the choices that we make in our interior landscape. What does that say about the culture we live in? Is that a theme that if I'm using two large words because I know that you're not a native speaker of English, just ask me again.
No, I'm good.
So that's a theme that I want to talk about. I want to talk about a little bit about your. I hear about your thoughts, about some of the different eras of and phases of design history, and what that might tell us about those cultures or, you know, periods of history. Or the format is: I usually throw out a bunch of questions, and then we take a breath and we have a little musical break, yes. And then we get into any of those things. So these are the themes. How does what we choose tell us about our culture, good or bad? What about different periods of time, and what can we perhaps imagine those times were like by looking at the things that they used or they chose to have in their interior landscape? What are some of your favorite periods of time for furnishings? And then anything else that comes up?
That sounds great.
Okay, let's have a few minutes of Dave Brubeck, please. Burning Down the House here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and this afternoon we're speaking with Daniela Ohad Smith about, in a sort of tangential way, culture, furnishings, and fine things.
Good, beautiful things.
Beautiful things.
Living with beautiful things.
Yeah. Well, let's just start out with your favorite, art slash craft slash furnishing periods of time.
Well, that's going to be very hard. Everybody's asking me what is my favorite.
Pick three top favorites.
I love minimalism. I love modernism. Many phases of modernism. This is my own taste.
Yes. Well, of course.
For my own home.
Oh, that's nice.
But I also love to appreciate other periods.
Well, so tell us the sort of things that you would choose to have in your house and why.
You know, I started actually collecting design many years ago, before it was called collecting design. In the mid-80s, when I moved here, I bought a house, and it was all furnished with Nakashima furniture.
Mm.
And I loved it.
Goodness.
Yep. So I went to visit him at his studio in New Hope, Pennsylvania. It was 1987, and I remember that day very well. I tell you why. Because it was the hottest day of the year, and I was pregnant with my twins.
Oof.
And it was so hot that the following day I had to go to the hospital.
I brought it on.
So I went to visit Nakashima, and I was, I fell in love right away. I've lived with design ever since. I think living with great design, with things you love, is very important for the well-being, for having happy family life. I truly believe in that.
Well, that supposes that people actually think about what they have in their house, which also, it seems to me, requires a little bit of education.
Education doesn't hurt, but today we are in a period, a really interesting period, where design is so important in our culture, in everybody's life. One of the images that I really love to show my students is the image. Do you know that image of Steve Jobs in his empty house? Have you ever seen that?
Yes. Yes.
With one Tiffany lamp.
Yeah, I think is that where he's sitting on the floor?
Yes.
So he's sitting zazen or something. And
right.
He maybe has something that he's sitting on, but there's nothing in the room. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, well, he was an extreme case. I mean, he's a very interesting character.
He's interesting, and he also has a central role, I think, in disseminating the idea that design is important. So one of the lines in his biography is that he was living in an empty house because he couldn't find anything he loved.
I also read in that biography, that's a Walter Isaacson,
yes,
biography, that his wife recounts that it took them 8 years to decide on a sofa because they had to debate what is the function of a sofa and do we need one, which is interesting. You know, it's I could understand that somewhat. I'm willing to have a sofa on conventional terms, that it allows two or three people to sit on the same thing at the same time, that's not just a plank. You know, it's a multiple-use piece of furniture. At the same time, I question having a television. Do I want to have this appliance that provides instant distraction?
So, do you have one?
I have a television, but I don't have any.
Cable.
I don't have any cable service. Okay. I don't have satellite. It's only connected to a DVD player.
Okay.
So it's...
But you have the internet. What about that?
Yes, I have the internet. There's plenty on Netflix. In terms of selecting what comes into your house, you know, for the longest time, I would not have a computer if it wasn't a ThinkPad, because I like the way... very much that the original ThinkPads were designed. You know, they were very austere, and it was like, well, this is a serious machine. And of course, I was a real sucker for the little red track point in the middle of the keyboard. But then it didn't become so important anymore.
I think that we are collecting objects throughout our lives, and then at the end, not at the end, but when you're 40 or 50 or 60, it really tells the story of your life. And I think your home is a great expression of everybody's identity, whether you have a lot of money to furnish it or not.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. An old acquaintance of mine came to my new apartment. Sort of new. I've been back in the city for about a year after 20 years in Connecticut. And what I've chosen to keep is an interesting collection.
Okay. Can you tell me about it?
Well, I have an ergonomic desk chair. It's the Freedom Chair by Niels Diffrient. Do you know that chair?
No, I don't.
It's highly articulated structure, and you can lean back and you can raise and lower the arms, and it's well cushioned, and it's much more comfortable than an Aeron chair, for example. But it's a rather large object in a moderately sized apartment, but it makes a statement about my own commitment and my interest in ergonomics. It's also very comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's the first chair that people choose when they come in, and they usually don't want to get up and
sit down
and give it away because it's very comfortable. So let's go back to Nakashima, George Nakashima, I think it is.
Yes.
And a lot of my younger colleagues may not know about Nakashima. Describe his work.
So George Nakashima was an American architect. He lived in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and he was born in Washington State. He was a graduate of Yale School of Architecture. And when he, as many Japanese, American Japanese, he was sent to a working camp during the war. And this is where he learned how to craft furniture. And then he settled in New Hope, and he was making furniture by hand. And he crafted them out of really amazing planks of wood that he was acquiring all over the world. And in 1989, there was the first retrospective exhibition of Nakashima at the then Museum of American Crafts. Mm-hmm. It was curated by my mentor, Derek Ostergaard. And it is the first time that the work of George Nakashima, the furniture that he made, was put in a context of modernist design, not craft, not Japanese, but modernist design. And I think that period, like the late 80s and early 90s, is when you see the first, the earliest studies of design, the way that we know them today.
You mean apropos of the the Apple sort of minimalism sort of?
No. Meaning that up until then, if you read design books, I'm talking about objects, not mm-hmm. architecture. Mm-hmm. And the study of design was very much in its infancy when I started studying design in 1990. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that writers talk about chairs and they just describe the chair aesthetically. And today we don't do that. We look at the chair and we think about what does it say about our culture, about our taste, about our time.
Also about how does it solve the problem of being seated? Well, I mean, look, ergonomics is all about that, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you don't know the work of Niels Diffrient then, but or perhaps you do.
I do.
I mean, he was a designer at Henry Dreyfuss, and then he was at Human Scale. And I guess he's still around.
Really?
I think he's very old.
So from what I've heard so far, it's very important to you that the furniture is comfortable.
If it's a piece of, if it's something to sit on, I think it is important.
Okay.
I mean, we learn a lot by comparing. If we're talking modern architects, we could suppose that modern architecture really begins in the 1880s. And so I can think of two architects who designed furniture who could not be more different. Frank Lloyd Wright designed chairs, and they were terribly uncomfortable, but they were like miniature buildings, and they were expressing ideas that he had about form, purely form. On the other end of opposition, we have Charles Eames, who is was trained as an architect, and of course he did create his own very important house in Pacific Palisades, California, and we know all about the California Case Studies House, but we mostly remember him for his furniture.
Yes.
And I'm too young to have met Mr. Wright, but I was very happy to meet Mr. Eames.
Wow, okay.
And I could not give you a better example of a generous and warm-hearted and accommodating designer than Charles Eames.
And totally charismatic.
Yes, but also extremely... extremely open. He spoke to us about the need that as a designer, you should be a good host. And you should ask, what can I do for you? How can I help you? So if you're asking me, do I think that it's important for furniture to be comfortable? I would say yes, most of the time.
But you know, the two examples that you just gave are great examples because they tell the story of the period. You know, Charles Eames worked in the 40s and 50s.
That's right.
And this was the time when industrial design was flourished. This was the time when the star designer sort of culture was born. And for him, as well as for the other members of his generation, the most important thing was to design a chair that would be comfortable. Frank Lloyd Wright was working in a totally different time. So this is exactly what I'm talking about. You look at a piece of furniture and it tells you something about the culture, about the people, about the time that it was made.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a good point. It's a very good point. So I have to admit, I have never seen in real life a Nakashima piece of furniture.
You can go to the Metropolitan Museum.
Yeah, but they won't let me touch it or sit on it.
Yes, they would, in the Japanese wing, absolutely.
Oh, in the Japanese wing?
Yes.
Yeah, you mean where?
It's a sitting room.
At MoMA?
No.
Oh, at the Metropolitan Museum. Yeah. Oh, where there's the room.
There is a special room
with the water and the tokonoma, and there's like a rock garden.
It's near that room.
There's another room then, because recently there's a room with all the calligraphed tapestries on silk that are historical, and then there's a room adjacent to that with the tokonoma mat, the tatami mats. Tokonoma is the shrine on the side wall there. And there's a rock and there's water and there's a water sculpture. But right. There's another room, you're saying.
So there is another room. It's a library. It's sort of a sitting room.
Oh,
library.
Yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes,
and
yes.
And Nakashima did the furniture. And also another place. You told me you live on the Upper West Side, right?
Yes.
So if you go to St. John the Divine.
Yes.
There is a big table that Nakashima donated. He called it Peace Table.
Oh, yes. Are you sure it's still there? When the cathedral caught fire, I had the impression might have...
I know it's there, but I don't know whether it's been out all the time. I don't know.
Uh-huh. The Peace Table. Yes, 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 yes. That rings a bell. I remember it was quite a while ago that was... given to them, and they were very happy. That wasn't a part of a... let's not get stuck on Nakashima's peace table.
Okay.
but yes, now I recall that sort of library room, that reference room, and it's all wood. And so his furniture is in there, yes.
Yes.
We'll have to check that out. It sounds great. So that I can arrange my thoughts.
But if just to continue of what you just said before, if you
yes.
look at the collectible furniture of today, of our time, like circa 2010, it's not the comfort that stands at the center of the thinking of this furniture. It's more... experimental technologies, very sophisticated materials. Mm-hmm. So the comfort is coming next.
Let's take a little break.
Yeah.
And come back and get into that in some depth next.
Thank you. shoreline. I see the white caps of baseball diamonds. Nice weather down there. I see the school and the houses where the kids are. Places to park by the factories and buildings, restaurants and bars for later in the evening. Then we come to the farmlands and the undeveloped areas, and I have learned how these things work together. I see the parkway that passes through them all, and I have learned how to look at these things. And I say, I wouldn't live for you if you paid me.
Burning down the house. Yeah, I wouldn't live there if they paid me to. In a lot of parts of contemporary life, we were just about to get into a discussion of what's hot right now and what's it all about. We're speaking with Daniela Ohad Smith, an observer of culture and how it is reflected in furnishings and things that we put into our interior landscape. So you were saying that here in the 2000s, it's not necessarily about comfort the way that it was in the post-war era. It's about something else.
No, it's absolutely. And can I mention something about my program?
Oh, of course, please.
Okay, great, thanks. So the program is called Collecting Design, and it is a program of three different institutions. It's taking place at the New York School of Interior Design, and it is a program of Modern Magazine. And I'm saying Modern Magazine because this is exactly the niche, this is exactly the issue that Modern Magazine is occupied with collecting design. And also Phillips Depreux, the auction house, which is a great place to buy and to learn about design. And going back to your question, this week we are going to have a guest, a speaker. Every week we're having another guest speaker who is sharing their advice and their expertise with the class. And this week it's going to be Jennifer Olshin, and she's the director of a gallery called Friedman Benda. Do you know that gallery?
I don't think I've been there. I've read about it.
Okay.
Where are they located?
It's in Chelsea. And I mention this because Friedman Benda represents some of the most exciting contemporary design today. Work by Joris Lohrmann and Ron Arad. And when you go to the gallery and you look at the objects, you understand that it's not about what is the most comfortable. It's about the sculptural, artistic, technological innovation of the object and the way that the object is playing a role in the interior space. So if we go back for a second to Charles Eames in the 50s, you know the objects are very quiet, right?
Yes.
Quiet. Neutral.
Well, after a world war, the men and women who were involved in fighting that, I should imagine, although my parents didn't ever talk about it, I think they probably want it quiet.
Yes, that's... Yeah, I haven't thought about it, yes. And the objects are integrated within the space. They're very sort of neutral. But if you look at objects today, they are dramatic. They are screaming. They look like sometimes huge sculptures. They're always objects that have function, because otherwise it's not design.
Then it's just merely a decorative object.
If it's a chair, if you can't sit on it, then it's not a chair.
Right. Or well, if we go back to the example of Mr. Wright, they were chairs, but you wouldn't want to sit on them.
You'd well, line them some up. Collectors today love to sit on them. Are you referring to something specific?
In his prairie school houses, he had some chairs that were, and I think they're in a museum now, where the chairs and the table and the lighting fixtures were all one set piece, all very orthogonal, and he even admitted that they were uncomfortable to sit in.
Yes, when you go to Falling Water, have you been there?
I have not been there yet.
So you should. It's only 8.5 hours drive from New York.
Yeah.
But when you go to Falling Water and you go to the room, the little bedroom of Edgar Kaufman Jr.,
yes,
and it is so small, it's basically half of the size of the studio. And you can imagine that in this room he fit a library, a bed, a desk, and a chair in this room. And nothing is comfortable. Not that they let you sit on it, but you can tell.
Yes, but it was a boys' room, or Edgar Kaufman Jr. didn't. But it was a summer house, so he didn't live there.
It was
all the
a
time.
Summer house, and he was not living. He was an adult by the time that they built the house.
Well, you know, Wright was good at having big concepts and working out the little details later. But back to present day, so. If these objects presently being created scream for attention, does it mean that people want to have something that's exciting in their personal environment because the rest of their lives are dull?
No. It's because this is the language of our time, of our age, and because people love design, and design is very important, and people want to express their own taste with their choices of objects. So you can go to IKEA. And I love IKEA. You can go to IKEA and you can buy a very sort of simple, plain sofa.
Sure.
Then you can put a really interesting armchair next to it, and that's it, and that's a statement.
Yes, or a very vanilla sofa and put an interesting rug over it.
Yes.
that's what I have.
That's what you have?
I have a very vanilla IKEA sofa, $500 sofa, but I have a Native American blanket. It's very colorful.
It's beautiful.
Over it, and it makes perfect sense.
And it makes a statement, right? It's,
yeah.
It's something that not everybody has. I mean, I'm
right.
Sure many, many people own that same sofa.
Sure.
But not everybody has it presented this way.
No, not everyone's been to the same Indian reservation that I went to out in Shinnecock, out near the Hamptons, and bought that particular blanket. But I bought it because I liked it. I liked the color and I liked the patterns. And it did, it pleases me. It's like having fresh flowers without having to get a new collection of fresh flowers every day, because it's very bright and it's colorful and it has a nice palette.
And when did you buy it?
The blanket?
Yes.
Oh, just in the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how it wears. I mean, if in 5 years I'm not happy with it anymore, I can always fold it up and put it away.
Or give it as a gift.
Well, I don't think people are going to want a used blanket, but yes, I could do that. So you have, I mean, in your, let's turn the table. So in your house, you've got all this Nakashima furniture.
No, I have other things too. This was just the beginning.
Ah, just the beginning.
I have other things. I love to, when I travel, I love to buy objects. But the one thing that is very characteristic in about collecting design is that people are living with the objects. And this is, I find this is extremely appealing and interesting to me. It's not something that people put in storage, but they really live with the objects. And unlike paintings where you have, you know, many collectors of art put paintings away and sometimes they change what's on the wall, with design collection, it's happened to be things that people really live with every day.
Yes. Which makes me think suddenly of Shaker furniture.
I love Shaker furniture.
Well, you know, that's an acquired taste. When Charles Dickens, the English novelist, came to the United States in the 1860s, someone took him out to meet some Shakers, and he found that Shaker furniture was hideous because it was not embellished. He found it horrifying in its simplicity.
I'm not surprised because he came from Victorian England.
Sure.
And there is nothing more contradictory to the furniture that he probably lived with.
Sure.
Than Shaker. I love Shaker. It's perfection.
In a very modern and minimalist way, but that they weren't thinking modern; they were thinking simplicity.
They were thinking simplicity and integration into their holy, sort of sacred lifestyle.
Yes,
but so many modernist designers looked back to the Shakers.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for to go back to the. The image of Steve Jobs sitting in an empty house. I think there's a lot that appeals in modern life where things are very overwrought with pressures and noise and activity, that simplicity can have a real appeal. I for myself, have not yet actually put any art on the walls of my apartment. I like the purity of just a beautiful wall with nothing on it.
Okay.
I have a small mirror just inside the front door and a small shelf to put something, you know, some candles or put the keys there, and one architectural drawing, and that's it. Everything else is just pure wall.
But listening to you, it sounds like you love your space.
It works for me, but it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. You know, if I acquire something, then something has to go away, because clutter. I find clutter is very bad. Of course, that's not just me. That's one of the precepts of feng shui. That clutter is very bad. It gets in the way of the free flow of energy. So let's go back to what are some of your other favorite periods of time, and what have you learned from them? We talked about Shakers and, you know, modernism and Nakashima. What about Biedermeier?
Oh, I love Biedermeier. Biedermeier has actually a great place in my childhood because I came from a family that emigrated from Germany. And my grandmother had her entire house furnished with Biedermeier.
Wow.
And I want to remind you, this was the 50s. In the 50s, all the immigrants who came to Palestine in the 30s were not interested in Biedermeier anymore because it was antique and it was old. And in the 50s, everybody wanted everything new,
yeah,
and modern and colorful. So she was smart, and she also had a fantastic taste. I was very inspired by her. And she had her entire house furnished with Biedermeier. And Biedermeier, so this is why for me, the image of good taste is something that is synonymous with Biedermeier.
Mm.
And Biedermeier is, do you like Biedermeier?
I do. A lot of our younger colleagues won't know what Biedermeier is at all. To me, I think of, and I may be wrong in terms of historical timeline, but I think of the music of Schubert when I think about Biedermeier.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Biedermeier was a period between, let's say, 1815 and 1845.
Yeah.
And it's a time. It's really interesting time. And you said that you love the Wiener Werkstatt.
I do. I really do like the work of the Wiener Werkstatt.
So yeah. I'll tell you that many, many of the figures of the Wiener Werkstatt were inspired by Biedermeier, especially Hoffmann.
I could see that.
Because Biedermeier was the time of renewal. It was the early 19th century, the beginning of the bourgeois, the middle class.
And there was a lot of revolution going on.
Yes.
And the people who could afford Biedermeier furniture, for those of you who don't know, is very restrained in terms of ornament, but it uses very precious, very beautiful and precious materials.
But
like ebony, black, very black woods, but gold accents, and then there might be burly maple that just reveals its beautiful grain with a nice lacquer finish, and that's it.
And what's interesting, this was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and cabinet makers learned how to make veneers. So they could make so many pieces of furniture out of one plank of wood.
Right.
And it was great for the middle class. It was inexpensive at the time. And today it's also inexpensive. People moved away from Biedermeier.
I mean, you can acquire Biedermeier furniture for not so much anymore?
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, that'd be wonderful. I would love to have a Biedermeier console.
So that's the time.
Oh, yeah.
And Biedermeier is anonymous. It's anonymous. You know, today people are looking for names. They want to know that this chair was designed by a name. Carlo Molino or Ettore Sottsass.
Right.
But in the Biedermeier period, most furniture, let's say 95%, was anonymous.
I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, if you were talking about the English speaking, and Biedermeier was this was it in the German speaking world,
in Scandinavia.
Ah, I did not know that. Let's. See, time just flies past. Let's take five and come back and talk about Sottsass in Memphis a little bit.
The program was sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards and Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
burning down the house. Now, we're not going to play all 4 minutes and 55 seconds of Brubeck Group with Take 5. Curtis B. Wayne here on Burning Down the House with Daniela Ohad Smith, and we're talking about furniture and objects, collecting design, which is Daniela's specialty. We're just about to talk about a little bit about Emilio Sotsis, the Memphis Group, which gets into the whole era of postmodernism, the 1980s, and some really crazy furniture that was designed by, in part, by architects, including, for example, Michael Graves. And now we see the sort of legacy of that in the recent times with Michael Graves designing crazy shit for Target, although I think his contract has now been suspended, and they're beyond Michael now.
Collectors love postmodernist furniture.
At the time, I found it very amusing. We were talking about the early and middle 1980s when, here in the United States, Ronald Reagan was our president, and the economy was recovering from the oil crises of the 1970s, and people just wanted to make a lot of money. And I myself worked in Wall Street, and it was one of the many different decades of greed. But yet at the same time, we had the Memphis Group, and they were designing things like a chair upholstered in purple with orange spots and strange proportions. And you say that people love to collect that stuff now.
Yes, and they were totally radical. Memphis.
Oh, absolutely.
Not only Memphis, but also the other groups that work in Italy in the 70s and early 80s. And they just took design and they turned it upside down. And they embraced everything that for decades was considered bad taste, color, texture.
Yes.
Forms. Everything that was considered by modernism as taboo,
right.
They did, right?
You know, now that I think of it, I should have worn a very Memphis necktie that I happen to have in my collection. It's electric blue with bright red polka dots. And I think I got it in 1986. And it was right on the edge between being wonderfully audacious and in atrocious taste. And that's why I loved it so much. So it was very much a piece of that era.
So you loved colors.
Well, who doesn't love color? I mean,
well, you know, right now we're in time when we live in sort of colorless homes, colorless clothing. No?
Color is very controversial. When I go back to see the student shows at my undergraduate alma mater, Cooper Union, and I walk around the show, and because they have an annual student show, I see that the architecture students are afraid to use color, and the painters don't know how to use color, and the photographers seem like they're colorblind. I think color is, or color theory is something that's not being taught any longer, perhaps. I don't know.
I don't think it's been taught, no? Not as far as I know. Not in the schools where I teach.
Yeah.
No.
Which is unfortunate. I was happy to be the beneficiary of being taught by students of Paul Klee. And we did a lot of color work and just pure collage. Totally non-figurative and just color on color and seeing how the different colors work together and learning about palettes so that when we saw, for example, a painting by Ingres, you know, the French portraitist from the 1830s.
Yes.
And we could understand how his palette worked together so beautifully, which is about at the same time as Biedermeier, but in France. But we were taught that, you know, we didn't just happen upon it. We were actually taught about that. So I can see really a great benefit for what you're trying to teach by getting people to look at items that have been designed.
How to look at objects and how to really to elevate your taste, because you can only have great taste if you look and if you know. That's my philosophy.
I agree.
That taste, you're not born with taste. No. Maybe you're born with tendency to develop your taste.
Well, in many ways, it's a lot like developing one's palate in food. You have to be introduced to different things and different seasonings in order to understand what you're tasting. Right?
And to become a connoisseur.
That's right. It's a matter of training, and it starts with what am I seeing or what am I tasting? And the same thing with music. What am I hearing? We do have a little bit of time. Let's just take a minute of some Prokofiev Scherzo and come back and talk about our current times. Burning Down the House with Daniela Ohad Smith, and we're going to wrap up our conversation about collecting design and training the visual palette by learning how to look. And what about our current times? Give us some thoughts.
About our time?
Yes. Where are we?
Oh.
Are we lost? Or,
No.
Emerging?
We're in a great time, but If you're talking about collecting design, and this is the theme that my new program is focusing on, it's a fairly new area that became so exciting and dynamic and dominant in the marketplace over just the past decade. And it's an area that has not matured yet. It makes lots of headlines. People are very interested. You can read about it everywhere. And this is the first time that we put together a program that really trains people in that area, in that complicated area. And today we are at a time where objects defines our spaces, our domestic spaces. We're in a time where people are very conscious about design. Everybody loves to have iPhone. Even if you are 12 years old, they love to have iPhone. Why? Because it's more beautiful. I don't remember in the 80s or the early 90s where kids were so conscious about design.
No, of course not. Kids weren't conscious of design at all. Maybe people in their 20s, and maybe if they had been to some sort of design training, might be conscious of design. Yeah.
Yes, and if you look at homes, if you look at magazines, design magazines of the 80s and 90s, you're going to be surprised how different homes looked than today. Very different. So in 100 years, when somebody is going to teach about, let's say in Cooper Union, your school, someone is going to teach about interior design of the era of the turn of the 21st century, there are going to be very specific rules, aesthetics, choices.
Right. Yeah. And I'm aware of that, you know. In my 20s, I had a Dieter Rams stereo. And then, of course, it wore out, and I didn't realize that you couldn't get any more of those, and I got rid of it.
Oh.
It was a big mistake. I know. Now I have a Henry Kloss radio, you know. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Dieter Rams' poor cousin. But I bought it because of the way that it looks, and I had the notion that the sound would be good, and the sound is good, and it's Dieter Rams-like, you know.
Or if you go to the Conran shop, and you just told me that you love
I love the Conran shop. Yes, you know, I can't go in there but think, oh, I'll take one of each.
So when you go to the Conran shop, it's all about loving and stimulating your love for design.
I like the stuff that Terence Conran selects for his shops because a lot of it is really good as good solid background to life. You know, it's some of it's not calling much attention to itself other than its pure its purity and its simplicity. I mean, if you want a really good white coffee mug, you have to go to the Conran shop because the man has exquisite taste.
Exquisite. And I was so fortunate to be in London last February. Who goes to London in February, right?
Well, there was a show of his stuff.
There was a show.
What, was it at V&A or something?
No, at the London Design Museum.
Uh-huh.
And and it was a retrospective. So you could really follow what he had done since he started. And it's apparent that he has a distinctive taste. And the entire store really is built around his taste.
Yeah.
Do you know that he himself personally approves every object that go to the
city? I don't doubt it. It's unfortunate that he doesn't have his big Conran shop at Citicorp Center anymore, or up there at 53rd and Lex. But there is a Conran shop now. It's in a basement of ABC Carpets down in Flatiron. If you you almost have to discover it on your own. You would never know it was there, right? But it's there.
It's there, and once you go down there, you are in a different world.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a world within a world. It's so different than anything else at ABC, isn't it?
Absolutely different. Yeah. It's a fluke that it's at ABC, but it's good that it's somewhere in New York.
I know, and they have like cool things like a designed ping pong table and Philip Stark speakers. It's just a place to explore.
Yeah. Free plug for the Conran shop at ABC on Broadway at 18th Street. Those of you who don't want to spend any money, you can go to Fish's Eddie at 19th and Broadway, but that's sort of a poor relation to Conran. You know Fish's Eddie. He's a cheap pottery and glassware and stuff like that. Anyway, there are few places to go. I mean, IKEA is okay, but it only goes so far. I mean, that's really just mass market stuff.
It's mass market, but you can find, you really need to train your eyes. And to train your eye, you need to look a lot. And IKEA, if you go to IKEA, there are some great objects. It's just that you cannot live with them. When you have the entire home furnished in IKEA, it looks like a store, right?
No, to me,
don't want to do that.
No, to me, it looks like a Swedish experiment in social housing. And you must only have blonde children, and you must only go around wearing your socks or barefoot. But no, it's a whole aesthetic thing, and it speaks of well, we'll have to talk about the whole Scandinavian social experiment some other time. But I'm a big fan of that period of Danish and Norwegian and some Swedish and, of course, Finnish because of Aalto, designed between about 1925 and 1955. I think this is just a wonderful period.
How can you not love it?
I mean, because they understood, let wood be wood. Let wood do things that only wood can do. Let steel do what steel can do. Let ceramics do what ceramic wants to do. Which, to my mind, is very architectural in the highest sense, and it's a great delight. And I hope that I can live a long time, because I'm always curious to see how things work out.
What things?
Well, in architecture, this period of formalism that doesn't necessarily create buildings that work very well, but they look very interesting. I find it disturbing.
I'm not going to ask you for examples.
I'm not a big fan of Hadid.
Did you see her a proposal for the Louvre?
No.
Okay.
I try to avoid that stuff, but I'm sure it looked like a train wreck.
I went to Maxi, actually.
What did you think? Let me ask you a yes-no question. Do you like going up stairs that are suspended in space way up high? You know, I mean, you see the money shot of Maxi is these black stairs going up into space. We don't see so much of the gallery space. We see those ridiculous stairs going everywhere.
There is very, very little gallery space. Very little, comparing to the size of the building.
Yeah.
But she's the star. She's a star architect.
She is a star architect. And
yes,
whenever I speak ill of her, people say, you're just envious.
And by the way, she's making amazing furniture for collectible at the collectible in a limited edition. And she right now she's showing a wonderful series of furniture at the David Gill Gallery, and it all looks like it is ice floating.
Okay, that's nice.
Okay.
I like glass. I like glass works.
It's not glass, it's resin.
It's
but
resin.
You should look it up. I'll send you an image.
Okay, good. David Gill.
Yes.
And that's in New York?
No, that's in London.
Ah, well.
And it's an exhibition of, I think, six tables, and they're all made of very sophisticated, progressive technology.
Well, I've used resin in bespoke pieces in commissions that I've had, so resin is nothing new. I'm sure they've got a website with pictures. Before we go, give us a URL, a web address for some of your endeavors.
Okay, thank you. So to register to the course, it's www.modernmagazine.com/collectingdesign. Modernmagazine.com/collectingdesign.
Very good. And do you have a website?
Me? Yes. It's my name, DanielaOhad.com.
All right. Excellent. I think we've run beyond our allotted period of time, but this is so delightful. I hope that you will come back, and I hope that you have a wonderful trip to Kyoto.
Thank you, Curtis, and thank you so much for inviting me. It was so much fun.
Good. Well, we try to have fun here.
Yes.
And when you come back, you'll have to tell us all about what you've discovered in Kyoto.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely.
And for my younger colleagues, go check out George Nakashima's stuff. You'll find it very, very thought-provoking. This has been Daniela Ohad Smith on Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.